This is Fresh Air. You may think of a youth detention center as a place to punish young people charged with crimes. Mary Previty sees it as a place to save their lives. Since 1974, Previty has been the administrator of the Camden County Youth Center in New Jersey. Young people are sent there after they are arrested and held while they await trial. The average stay is a couple of weeks, but some remain for several months. About 850 young people pass through the center each year. Previty says they come from varied racial backgrounds and from every economic group, but the majority are the children of the poor. I asked her if she's found certain patterns in the problems that these young people have faced.
Families falling apart is probably the most important theme. If a boy or girl doesn't have a father and mother rooting for them, supporting them, advising them, telling them when to come in, setting patterns for them, expectations, hopes, making a dream of the future in their head, that boy or girl is going to soak up the messages from the street. And more than anything else, the crumbling family is the theme that we see among boys and girls that come to the youth center.
What else?
Another is the need for money, the fascination with glitzy clothes, owning records or cars or dirt bikes, the whole materialism that you've got to be surrounded and having this in order to be somebody. You're not really anybody at all unless you're surrounded with all these. I mean, it has to be the name brand. It can't just be nice, clean jeans. And some of the boys even tell me it isn't just the name brands. It's got to be pressed at the dry cleaner so somebody knew that you were able to afford to get this done at the dry cleaner. It's the whole outside show is who you are, not who you are on the inside.
Have a lot of the young people who you've seen been abused by their parents? Is that a contributing factor too, do you think?
Very, very common. I would say there are times in the girls' population, we may have 90 to 100% of the girls have been physically and sometimes sexually abused. And we feel that it's a common theme with some of the boys, but boys are not as quick to talk about being victims of sexual abuse as girls are. But abuse is a very, very common theme. Troubles with school. Most of our children are way behind in school performance of what you would expect a boy or girl that age. And we will get boys 10 years old, do not know the letters of the alphabet, but they can tell you how to train or kill a dog. And this theme of violence is a thread that it just comes through all portions of their life. I think one of the things that really astonished me, we began to see boys and girls just blossoming in our classroom. And you'd say, why is this? We've had people walk down the halls and say, well, these school rooms here would be the envy of any schoolroom in America. You wouldn't walk in any public or private school as orderly as this. And I began to wonder how that could be with children in a juvenile detention center, all of a sudden taking seriously their school. Well, I have to give a lot of credit to the teachers. But then I began to dawn on me. We took terror out of their lives. We discovered that when boys and girls come in, one of the first messages the officers will say is, we will not let you hurt somebody while you're here, and we will not let anyone hurt you. So there was a sense that you're going to be safe in this place.
What's your philosophy at the detention center about how to help the young people who are there in the short time that you have to spend with them?
Well, first of all, there's only one set of rules, Mary Previty's rules. The boys and girls come from a squishy world with no rules, no structure. Do whatever you want. If there have been no parents around, they come and go in their homes as they please, when they please. I had one boy say to me, and he was a 13-year-old charged with murder. He said, a mom's supposed to say, don't do that. And he was horrified when he says, you climb out the window or you go away and she ain't even ask you when you come in. A world of no rules. And here is a kid saying, but she's supposed to ask me, begging for structure. So I say, we will make a world that is comfortingly predictable. There's nothing squishy about the floor you put your foot down here. You will do it this way and only this way. is not going to be unpredictable. It's not going to be uncomfortable. You will know every day when someone's going to wake you up. You will know every day when it's time to clean up. You will know when you're going to go to school. You will know when you're going to eat. You will know when you're going to go to bed. And there's a certain way that you talk to people. And there's a certain way that you will talk, that you will respond to people. So the predictable structure. Our children are living in an unpredictable world that is so frightening because they don't know when they put their foot down on any day, whether it's going to be solid or when it's going to be squishy. No child can feel safe in a world like that.
No, I've been reading a little bit about the center, and I read that one of the things that you do, there are clean and tidy competitions.
In which
people compete for how clean they keep their part.
My assistant complained to me early on that they were pretty piggy and beds weren't made, and we decided in competition, and so we decided that we would do a daily clean and tidy inspection, and I said, I'll be the one. That makes a good excuse for an administrator to be real close to the kids and in the midst of everything, and I rather like that. So the first day we introduced the clean and tidy, they said, well, you know, you have to have instant reward. So they'll never know you've been around unless you leave something on their windows. So I left a little M&M sticker or 3M sticker with a little message like good or marvelous or happy or proud or something like that, or fat, whatever their current language was. The second day, well, that was to show that their bedroom was wonderful and clean. And the next day, the social worker in the younger boys' unit came to me, and Leo said, well, my boys want to know where their stickers are. I said, well, Leo, I'm not going to put a sticker on everybody's door every day. He says, my boys want to know where their stickers are. They have been getting stickers on their door from that day to the present time, and some of them will wallpaper their bedroom door with stickers with all the words that I write on them and a happy face every day. We do enormous amounts of saying, we notice how good you're being, and we appreciate it.
My guest is Mary Previty, administrator of the Camden County Youth Center in New Jersey. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mary Previty, administrator of the Camden County Youth Center. There was an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer. It was just about a year ago. And it was an article about teenage violence. And after interviewing many people, the authors of this article reached the conclusion that teenagers feel little remorse or regret for their crimes. And they often think the victims were just asking for it. How does that mesh with what you've seen?
I think it's true. I think it often is true. A person, a human being who from the earliest age has been violated by being beaten or shouted at or not cared for, a four-year-old that has to be responsible for taking care of himself and any other brothers or sisters, that type of thing. There's a survival thing called distancing. And all of those terrors of being alone, there is no greater terror for a child than having no one to take care of you. None. That is the ultimate terror. The terror hides and runs into the cracks and crannies of a child's soul and is cut off. They hide behind all kinds of things, so all of a sudden, the feelings stop. And you see that. You hear it when you listen to a boy or girl talking to you. You hear about a kid that's been abandoned or has had this horrible thing, and I'm listening, I'm saying, I'm waiting to hear the tears. I'm waiting to hear the anger. I'm waiting to hear the voice go up or the voice go to a whisper, and I hear this flat, monotone talking about horrors. I get it every day when we do the student newspaper. Being stuck up, robbed at gunpoint, going to the funeral and seeing their friends buried, and a flat monotone like it was no big deal. And I keep saying, please let the tears come out. Please shout. Let me know that you care. And I suddenly realize it's like the post-traumatic stress syndrome. The feelings disappeared someplace long ago. I don't know where they're hidden. But when you squeeze out the terror and you hide and the anger and the rage, it will come out in other horrible ways. And it comes out in just what you described. No big deal. I wasted him. No big deal. It's a survival mechanism, and it isn't going to go away, because as long as we continue not nurturing children, not caring for them, not making them feel safe, not helping them to see the future, they have no investment in you or me or the neighborhood or the schools.
I want to ask you about something in your background that I have a feeling has some connection to the work you're doing now and the philosophy that you take. You grew up in China, where your parents were Methodist missionaries, and I believe it was at the beginning of World War II, you and all the students and teachers from your school were taken prisoners in a Japanese concentration camp after Japan invaded China. Did you have experiences in this concentration camp that helped you do the work that you're doing now in some way or understand how you should be doing it?
Well, I didn't think of that until much later, but I think a lot of what I do at the youth center is very similar to what our teachers that were marched off to prison camp with us. We had these marvelous Victorian schoolmarm missionary teachers in our school that were marched off with us. We didn't see our parents for 5.5 years, so you've got a whole school of children with no parents. And they seemed to know instinctively what to do with kids in a prison camp. It was the most astonishing thing.
Well, who did, the teachers?
The teachers did. The teachers did. And here were guard dogs and electrified wires and bayonet practice and all this, all the other horrors of war that no child should ever know. And these teachers would say, they didn't say it this way, but they made a very predictable atmosphere. We knew when we'd get up in the morning. Does that sound like what I said to you a bit ago?
Exactly.
We knew when we would get up in the morning, we'd hear Miss Stark come in to nudge us all to get up. We knew when we had to scrub our little portion of floor that was around our steamer trunks. We slept on steamer trunks. There were no beds. We knew when we were going to march off to eat. And the teachers insisted that we were going to continue with school, even though it meant sitting on the floor or sitting on the steamer trunks and using slates and a piece of chalk to do our schoolwork. And there was a very comfortingly predictable structure. And, of course, absolutely God was going to take care of us. There was no question about that. So that was a very comforting thing. They surrounded us with a world that we knew what to expect, despite Japanese guard dogs and Japanese bayonet practice around us. And I think I do much of the same thing at the youth center.
What kind of expectations of your behavior did the teachers have while you were in the concentration camp?
Well, our teachers, we were growing up in the time of Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret Rose, who were the princesses of Buckingham Palace. I was born British, so these were great characters in our life. And our teacher said, you will sit up straight with your backs up straight at the dining hall where you might be eating slop out of a tin can. And they said, there is not one set of rules for Buckingham Palace or outside world and another set of rules for the Weixian concentration camp. So we had to have rules and manners just like Princess Margaret Rose and Princess Elizabeth, even in the confines of a Japanese prison camp.
You have really just a few weeks with mm-hmm. most of the teenagers who come in, and you do what you can in that time to instill a sense of confidence, of positive thinking, but then they're going to be out, and if they're not sent to reform school or something, they're going to be back in the neighborhood where they got into trouble in the first place. What are the pressures on a young person when they go back home? Afterwards,
they're horrible pressures. They will be back in the same neighborhood, inside the same house. They'll be surrounded by their same friends. And I will tell you, most kids say it is almost impossible to break free from the patterns that they've developed with their friends, particularly if they don't have a supportive parent. If they don't have a dad or a mom that's setting the rules and really reining them in. So the neighborhoods just devour children. They'll say, you cannot stay in your four walls forever. Once you go out, you're down with the boys. And that pretty much is the truth. Many of the kids will say that school has no meaning for them. That there is really nothing positive to influence them. And I think that's the profound message that we need to get out to people. We have got to say, I am Mr. Mike in a grocery store, and I can be the only person that is going to touch this boy that comes in, and I will do it. Or I will take this girl who lives in my neighborhood that I see, and I will bring her into my home and listen to her. Listening is one of the most important things. We have got to feel that we can make a difference in our world, and it happens by small, tiny, tiny pieces, one child at a time.
Mary Previty is the administrator of the Camden County Youth Center in New Jersey. This is Fresh Air.